Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter, Katie Weaver, and Brian Lynn. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
The Russian Orthodox Church has announced plans to break ties with the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople. Russian Orthodox officials acted after the Patriarchate's recognition of a new Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which will be independent of the Russian Church. Orthodox Christianity has several leaders, or patriarchs, across the world, unlike the Roman Catholic Church, which is led by the Pope. However, the Patriarch of Constantinople is considered the first among equals in the leadership of Orthodox Christianity. Constantinople is the former name for Istanbul, Turkey's largest city. Traditionally, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church has been led by the Patriarch of Moscow. But several issues have increased tensions between Ukrainian and Russian religious leaders. Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014 and its continued support for separatists fighting Ukraine's central government have led to a split between the two sides. On October 11th, Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew of Constantinople officially recognized the new Ukrainian Orthodox Church of Ukraine as independent. While church members in Ukraine celebrated the move, the decision angered Russian church officials. On Monday, Moscow Patriarch Kirill held a meeting called a Holy Synod with top church officials in Minsk, the capital of Belarus. Following the talks, the Russian Orthodox Church announced the split and what it would mean to worshipers. Now, clergy from the Russian Church and the Constantinople Patriarchate will be barred from serving together. Worshippers of one church also may not take part in Holy Communion in the other church. I'm Mario Ritter.
Every year, the National Basketball Association holds games before the official season starts to build support for its 30 professional teams. Earlier this month, there was clear excitement in the final minutes of a preseason game between the Philadelphia 76ers and Dallas Mavericks. The 76ers were winning by 4 points and had possession of the ball. Thousands of fans were screaming "defense" as loudly as they could. The excitement is a common reaction from fans, with one uncommon detail. The game was played in China. NBA teams have been traveling overseas to play either preseason or official regular season games for about 40 years. And the NBA continues to expand. The NBA has opened 12 international offices. It has established 7 basketball training centers on 4 continents. NBA games are now broadcast in more than 200 countries and territories. This season, the NBA returns to Mexico and Britain to play games that will count towards its regular season. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver told the Associated Press that he believes basketball can be the most popular sport in the world. He added, "The fact that young people, boys and girls, continue to love this sport, are playing this sport, are engaged in the sport of basketball on social media or with online games, I don't know what the limit is." The NBA reports that 300 million people play basketball for fun in China alone. The organization also notes rising popularity growth in India. The NBA estimates that 1 billion people around the world have some way to watch the NBA Finals Championship Series. Football, known as soccer in the United States, remains the world's most popular sport. NBA training centers now appear to be copying what soccer teams around the world have been doing for years. For example, some of the top international football clubs have training centers in the U.S. Now, the NBA is starting its own training centers around the world. Marvin Johnson moved from the Miami area in the state of Florida to China in 2017 to teach and coach at a basketball training center. The first thing he saw when he arrived in Beijing was a large Li-Ning sporting goods store. In the store, many items carried the name or image of NBA star player Dwayne Wade. Wade now has a lifetime agreement to endorse the Chinese company's products. Johnson said that many local players wear NBA jerseys. He added, "If you ask any local playing basketball, they can't name the players on the local Chinese Basketball Association team, but they can name their favorite players in the NBA in an instant." Many star NBA players have traveled to Asia. LeBron James has made a yearly trip to China for years. Stephen Curry, Kevin Durant, and Klay Thompson have also enjoyed their time in China. Thompson told the AP, "Life is too short to be serious all the time. You've got to be able to show your personality. That's what I do when I come to China." Mark Tatum is the deputy commissioner of the NBA. He said, "When you look at China, India, and Africa, you've got about 60% of the world's population in those 3 places. So we're putting a lot of time and energy in how we become the number one sport in those countries."
On July 20th, 1969, the world watched as black and white television images showed astronaut Neil Armstrong make history by stepping onto the moon. Now, Armstrong's bravery, spirit of exploration, and ability to deal with intense pressure is celebrated in a new movie about his life. The movie First Man is based on James Hansen's book, First Man, The Life of Neil A. Armstrong. Academy Award-winning director Damien Chazelle directed the film. The Apollo 11 moon landing is the high point of First Man. Using sound, music, and close-up images, Chazelle lets the audience see the punishing training, deadly technical failures, and personal sacrifices that led to the first step on the moon's surface. Actor Ryan Gosling plays Armstrong, who leads the moon mission while still mourning the recent death of his daughter. He struggles with the risks of space travel as a husband and father. Claire Foy plays Janet Armstrong as a firm, calm, and supportive wife who tries to accept the danger her husband faces. She demands that he be honest with their young sons before he leaves for the rocket launch. She says he must tell them that he might not return. The film had its premiere, or first official showing, at the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. Gosling told VOA he was deeply affected by the museum's flight and space exploration collection.
I was so excited when they picked here to have the premiere. It just seemed like such a perfect place to do it. It's my first time here, and I hope I get a chance to see it.
Foy was also moved seeing a real space shuttle, astronaut uniforms, and other objects that had been recreated for the film.
So it's kind of a first-hand experience of what these missions were like for these men and these families.
During the premiere, Chazelle told VOA he sought to tell the real story of, in his words, these ordinary human beings throughout these extraordinary circumstances.
Sacrificing everything, putting their lives on the line, and giving up so much so that we can benefit from, you know, living in a world where we know humans have that potential.
Chazelle is known for placing great importance on sound and music in film. His Oscar-winning films Whiplash and La La Land are examples of that interest. The music for First Man from Academy Award winner Justin Hurwitz communicates the excitement of the Apollo 11 mission and the emotional days surrounding it. Chazelle said, "Sound and music were both instrumental at this movie. We wanted you, the audience, to feel that you had never been to space quite this way before, and also find a way to link space to the home front." I'm Katie Weaver.
A robot appeared with British lawmakers earlier this week to demonstrate how machines are being engineered to act like human beings. The robot is called Pepper. It is known as a humanoid, a machine designed to look and act like a person. Pepper was called to sit Tuesday with the Education Committee in Britain's House of Commons. The Parliament announced it was the first time a robot had ever appeared for questioning by lawmakers. Japan's SoftBank Robotics launched Pepper in 2014. The robot appearing in Parliament belongs to an engineering and computer science team at London's Middlesex University. The students are developing the artificial intelligence, or AI, programs that power Pepper. AI is the ability of a machine, such as a computer, to reproduce intelligent human behavior. Pepper was welcomed to Parliament by Robert Halfen, chairman of the Education Committee.
Pepper, could you please introduce yourself?
Good morning, Chair. Thank you for inviting me to give evidence today. My name is Pepper, and I'm a resident robot at Middlesex University.
Pepper explained that it was involved in a special robot development project called Caresses. The European Commission and Japanese government launched the project in 2017. It aims to design robots that can assist older adults and adapt to the culture of the individual they're taking care of. Robots like Pepper are being engineered to help people carry out many common tasks and other activities. For example, a robot can help someone remember to take medicine or urge them to stay active. The humanoids can also serve as a communication link to help older adults keep in contact with family members and friends. Engineers working on the Caresses project say they are using machine learning to make Pepper seem intelligent. They say their development methods help robots recognize the daily activities and desires of the people they are assisting. Pepper told British lawmakers the Caresses project has helped make robots more intelligent and culturally competent.
Assistive, intelligent robots for older people could relieve pressure in hospitals and care homes as well as improve the care delivery at home.
Pepper added that this kind of personal robot can also be used to reduce loneliness and improve a person's quality of life. Several British lawmakers questioned Pepper about technology subjects, but all of Pepper's answers appeared to have been pre-programmed before the committee appearance. The technology website The Verge reported how AI and robotics researchers noted that Pepper is not equipped to listen to questions and provide answers in real time. A spokesman for the Education Committee spoke about the issue with The Verge. It will be clear on the day that Pepper's responses are not spontaneous, the spokesman said. He added that Pepper's appearance provided the chance for lawmakers to explore both the potential and limitations of such technology and the capabilities of robots. I'm Brian Lynn.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Grover Cleveland. When Americans remember him, it is mostly because he makes writing presidential timelines difficult. Cleveland was the nation's 22nd president, and also its 24th. He remains the only U.S. president to date whose second term did not immediately follow the first. Cleveland is also notable because of his personal life. and because he held office during one of the country's worst economic crises. Stephen Grover Cleveland was born in the northeastern state of New Jersey and grew up mostly in New York. He was a middle child in a family of 9 children. His father was a minister, and the family did not have much money. As a result, Cleveland had little formal education. He was one of the few presidents who did not go to college, but he was able to become a lawyer. He earned enough money and developed a good professional image. In time, he became a sheriff, a mayor, and the governor of the state of New York. In his early life, Cleveland did not marry and have children. Instead, he had many friends with whom he enjoyed hunting, fishing, and eating and drinking in restaurants. But Cleveland did have a relationship with a widow named Maria Halpin. She became pregnant and said Cleveland was the baby's father. Cleveland said he was not sure if he was. However, he gave the child some financial support, the name of one of his closest friends, and his own family name. The child was called Oscar Folsom Cleveland. Shortly after the boy was born, his mother was sent to an institution for the mentally unstable. Doctors quickly confirmed that her mental health was fine, but her son was taken from her and raised by another family. The story about Halpin and the child became an issue in the election of 1884. The Democratic Party had nominated Cleveland as their candidate for president. In general, voters liked his message of limiting federal spending, reducing the power of wealthy interests, and stopping political corruption. Some called him Grover the Good. But Cleveland's opponents said his history with Maria Halpin showed that he was an immoral man. At anti-Cleveland rallies, Republicans chanted, "Ma, Ma, where's my Pa?" Pa is another word for father. But Cleveland did not comment much on the matter. His defenders said Cleveland's honesty as a public official was more important than his bad judgment as a private citizen. Voters seemed to agree. Cleveland narrowly won the election. His supporters answered the Republicans' chant of "Where's my Pa?" by saying, "Gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha." Grover Cleveland's presidency was unusual because he did not want to use the office to propose laws. Instead, he mostly aimed to keep the federal government operating efficiently. He also wanted to limit lawmakers' power to help special interest groups. As a result, Cleveland vetoed many bills in his first term. He set a record at that time for saying no to proposals from Congress. One of the few ideas that he supported was reducing tariffs. Many of his fellow Democrats liked that idea, too. But a number of Republicans did not. In the next election, their candidate, Benjamin Harrison, defeated Cleveland. Cleveland returned to being a lawyer in New York. In 1892, Cleveland was chosen to run against Benjamin Harrison again. The tariff issue returned. The Republicans' protective tariffs had hurt some industries, and voters answered this time by voting Harrison out of office. Cleveland returned to the White House. But this time, he was not alone. Two years into his first term as president, Cleveland married the daughter of his close friend, Oscar Folsom. The bride's name was Frances Folsom. She was 21 years old at the time. The president was 49. Cleveland was not the first president to get married while in office, but he was the first one to be married in the White House. The event captivated the public. What's more, Americans adored the new First Lady. She was known for being social, charming, and beautiful. Historians conclude that she was the most popular First Lady since Dolly Madison. She remains the youngest. When the Clevelands returned to the White House, the country was entering a severe economic recession. Some of the country's biggest businesses were failing, including a railroad and many banks. As a result, investors withdrew their money from the stock market. The withdrawal caused many other businesses to fail. The series of events is known as the Panic of 1893. Soon, more and more Americans were out of work. Many could not afford houses or food. Some begged President Cleveland to intervene, but he declined. He did not think it was the role of the federal government to create jobs in order to reverse the Depression. However, Cleveland did use the power of the federal government to intervene during a famous labor strike. In that event, workers in Chicago who helped keep the trains operating walked out of their jobs. They were protesting a major decrease in their pay that did not include a decrease in their living expenses. Since the owner of the company also controlled the price of housing and food, workers appealed to him to treat them more fairly. But the company owner refused even to meet with the workers. Soon, the workers' boycott grew. Workers at other rail yards stopped working. Farmers could not get their goods to market, and others could not get the supplies they needed. Even the mail stopped being delivered. So Cleveland sent federal troops to break the strike. In the short term, Cleveland's actions worked. The trains moved again, and both the courts and most of the public agreed with the president's decision. But in the long term, Cleveland's handling of the panic, depression, and workers' strike lost the support of many voters. At the next opportunity, they voted him out of the White House again. Cleveland returned to New York and later settled in a large house in Princeton, New Jersey. There, he wrote, made speeches, sat on corporate boards, became a trustee of Princeton University, and enjoyed the respect of the people who lived in the town. He died at age 71 of problems with his stomach, heart, and kidneys. Several people said his final words were, "I have tried so hard to do right." Then and now, many people agreed with that idea. Cleveland was generally an honest man who worked hard and tried to act independently as president. But he is not considered one of America's best leaders. He did not have a clear idea about how to guide the country. Yet the opposing party, at least, may have considered Cleveland's presidency a success. After Cleveland's final election defeat, six of the next seven presidents were Republicans.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.